Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I love soundcheck. I listen every day.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Author Michael Chabon has won a Pulitzer Prize. The Virginia Quarterly Review calls him one of the most celebrated writers of his generation. His latest music-heavy novel, Telegraph Avenue, is really good. But Michael Chabon sucks. Hey, it's not my opinion. I'm just quoting from MC himself. Listen.
I'm sorry. I just can't seem to get it together to focus. I'm very sorry to be left out of such a distinguished group. I suck. MC.
That's the band One Ring Zero from their so-called author project a few years back, where they got writers like Jonathan Lethem, Margaret Atwood, and Neil Gaiman to write lyrics for their songs. Michael Chabon's lyrics, though he didn't know it at the time, consisted of this email to the band apologizing for not being able to get it together and send in his contribution. He signs off with, "I suck, MC."
I'm very sorry to be left out of such a distinguished group. I suck, MC.
Fortunately, MC has gotten his act together enough to talk about his latest book and the music that inspired it. We'll hear from Michael Chabon in just a little while. Today is President's Day, a federal holiday that started out as a way to celebrate the birthdays of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, and then kind of extended to the rest of the commanders-in-chief, and ultimately just became a good day to find a good sale and go shopping. But back in 2008, Soundcheck talked with two musicians for whom President's Day is a little more than that. These guys wrote a song for every American president on a CD called Of Great and Mortal Men, 43 songs for 43 U.S. presidencies. Here's a song called Illuminating the Bright Lines about FDR.
The focus of the platform. No man by the bold intellect, Republicans, right wing. No, the Klan and all that fascists, they are also conservative. Can erase our response to the great depression or war.
We talked with the songwriters Christian Kiefer and Jefferson Pitcher about Of Great and Mortal Men on the eve of Election Day 2008, so George W. Bush was finishing his second term and Barack Obama hadn't yet taken office. Thus the lack of a 44th song for our 44th president, but more about that later. This massive 3-CD project was inspired by something called the February Album Writing Month Challenge, and I started by asking Jefferson just what that meant.
That is a songwriting challenge that was started by someone who had done the NaNoWriMo, which is a novel writing challenge where it forces you to write, in this case, songs very quickly. The idea being that you write 14 songs in the shortest month and post them on a website as you go for critique and support and whatnot. And I had done it the previous year, and I really enjoyed the process. So fast forward to the year that we wrote about the presidents, I wanted to write about something really concrete, and I had a long-standing interest in American history, and the idea just sort of stumbled in, as ideas do sometimes. And I then contacted Christian about it, who thought it was a really great idea, and we realized we only needed one more songwriter, and we could cover all but our current president.
And then you did have to cover our current president, so what happened with that?
Well, we just sort of waited. I was working on a demo of that song, and Christian beat me to it. And so he wrote that last song, and then we all contributed and wrote some of our own lyrics and added little touches, and all three of us sing on that one. So it was collaborative in that way.
All right. Let's hear a little bit. The song is called Through the Night, and this is the 43rd of the 43 songs, and it's about our 43rd president, George W. Bush. The song is called Though the Night. I think I said Through the Night, but it's Though the Night, and it comes from Of Great and Mortal Men, 43 songs for 43 U.S. presidencies, and this one is about the 43rd, George W. Bush, with my guests Christian Kiefer and Jefferson Pitcher and others in a kind of collaborative songwriting and performing thing here. Christian, Jeff was talking about how, you know, you guys sort of split up the first 42 presidents, came together and wrote this song for the 43rd. How do you, or do you, try and keep partisan politics out of the songwriting process?
Well, that's been a big issue of mine in particular in trying to keep a relatively even keel. I don't think anyone who listens to this project or pages through the book will have any confusion as to where our politics lie. We're definitely all three of us left of center, but we wanted to make sure that this piece of music or this piece of art would stand the test of time, or that's what we strove to accomplish. And I think for all of us, music that is particularly politically specific tends to lose relevancy rather quickly, and it might be very, very clever and interesting for a year or two or three, or as sort of a quirky idiomatic expression of the times. But we really tried hard, and I will say probably failed, to to keep our sort of party politics out of the equation.
Well, you know, with the George W. Bush song, I mean, there's a kind of melancholy that almost makes you like the guy. You know, it's the night is long and dark, and he's beset with doubts, and, you know, but then there is sort of a reference to, you know, a kind of a narrow worldview in America as the great, you know, power and stuff like that.
Well, that's all because of songwriters who've come before us, like Randy Newman and Lyle Lovett and Joe Henry and people like that, who have been good on the one hand at pointing the finger where it needs to be pointed, but also in understanding that people, even powerful people, are still people, and they still have hopes and dreams and bad dreams, and wives and dogs and kids. And Jefferson and Matthew and I were all very cognizant of looking at presidents, at least some of the time, as people. And the George W. song is essentially about him as a man, wondering if, you know, with the 8 years coming to a close, if he did the right thing, or mm-hmm. if he's Or if he did not.
All right, let's talk about another George W., and that is George Washington. Christian, you wrote this one, right?
I did.
It's called Washington Dreams of the Hippopotamus. Care to explain?
Yeah, well, you know, you do research for a tune, and as Jeff articulated, the February Album Writing Month challenge meant that there was really no time for very, very deep research to occur. So sometimes with a song, you'll find a tidbit, and the tidbit I found on Washington was that his supposed wooden teeth were actually dentures made in part from the teeth of a hippopotami. So, you know, as a songwriter, you almost have to just stop researching
at
that point. Yeah, you get that nugget and you think, okay, well, there's my tune. I've got to step, you know, I have to stop researching now, because if I find out too much more, it might derail the song. And, you know, with a song like Washington, it seemed to work.
All right, let's hear a little bit. Washington Dreams of the Hippopotamus from the album Of Great and Mortal Men.
At the first of everything in our situation will serve to establish a precedent. It is devoutly wished on my part that these precedents may be based on principles I said. Those dumbasses believed me. With their powdered wigs and piggy eyes, believe me. And I gnashed my hippo teeth and smiled, believe me. And the purple-headed beast will come back to claim its ivory prize. Martha said, with Braddock in the bullet chain and tattered coat, the horses falter, broken lead and burning halter they punched.
Washington Dreams of the Hippopotamus, the first of the 43 songs for 43 U.S. presidencies on the record, the three-record set called Of Great and Mortal Men by Christian Kiefer, Jefferson Pitcher, and Matthew Gerken. Christian's with us via ISDN from Sacramento. Jeff's on the phone from Detroit. Jeff, in terms of the sound of the album, I mean, Christian's piece uses a bit of, you know, flutes and marching drums. It's got a somewhat evocative sound of the Revolutionary War period, but for the most part, it seems like it's a pretty straightforward, contemporary-sounding collection of indie rock. Is there some creative anachronism at play here?
You know, I think in the same way that we wanted to keep a bit of distance from being overtly political, although we may all feel overtly political, in terms of the sound of the record, we didn't. I guess we were afraid that if we did too much of that, too much of making the song sound like period pieces in any way, that it would somehow devalue the songwriting and make it a bit gimmicky. Mm-hmm. I think the three of us were really, you know, we were interested in presenting this as another means of gleaning some information about American history that is untold. At least for me, growing up, going through the school system, you know, my knowledge of the American presidents is really just sort of what you learn about these icons, and not so much, as Christian mentioned, what you learn about them as men.
Right. So Christian found this thing about, you know, Washington's allegedly wooden teeth actually being made of hippo ivory.
Right.
What did you find about Harry Truman when it came time to write the Harry Truman song?
Well, Harry Truman was an interesting man to me. The first thing that happened was I had to grapple with the fact that here's a man who has been at the helm of one of the greatest atrocities, you know, in history, right?
The dropping of the bomb. Yeah.
And so as I was researching him, I discovered that he fought in the front lines during World War I. And didn't want to do that at all and came home and opened a menswear store with a close friend, which was his dream. And much to their chagrin, after 3 or 4 years, the store went bankrupt. And Truman lived what was described as a pretty destitute existence for about a decade. He owed money to debtors, and he eventually paid all of that off. And very quickly, just through public demand, rose into politics and found himself the vice president under Roosevelt. And after Roosevelt's death, all of a sudden, here was a man who was president and faced with a decision that I couldn't really, as much as I can look at it as and say that that was a horrible, horrific thing that he did, I can't imagine being in the position of having to make that decision. And it made me think a lot about how the circumstances of our lives often propel us in directions that are out of our control.
And certainly that you wouldn't have anticipated. And here's a guy who couldn't make a men's clothing store work, and now he's running the most powerful country on earth. And hence the title of the Harry Truman song, Suits and Fine Trousers versus Hiroshima.
Sold suits to fine men. Never pulled the trigger on my brother. Did some bad things. He killed some Americans. They float on the water of the harbor in the moonlight, like fish in the desert. Japan will pay for this, but I am a good man. I believe that Jesus would have done the same thing. Ruin will rain down. Ruin will rain down on them. What was I thinking? Will I rot in hell? What was I thinking? Oh God, just take me now.
The song is Suits and Fine Trousers versus Hiroshima, and it is from the 3-CD set of Great and Mortal Men, 43 songs for 43 U.S. presidencies, by my guests, Christian Kiefer, who's with us from Sacramento Public Radio, Jefferson Pitcher on the phone with us from Detroit, and Matthew Gerken is the third man behind the project, although there are many guests coming and going during the course of the 3 CDs. Christian, did you guys approach the contemporary presidents differently from the ones that you had to like go up and go back and look up in history books?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, the ones you have to look up in history books, there's no real pressure because nobody's going to care. Nobody's invested in what you say about William McKinley or Benjamin Harrison, but
right.
they are invested in what you say about Ronald Reagan.
And what do you say about Ronald Reagan?
Well, Ronald Reagan, I chose to focus not on his presidency because I couldn't think of a way to discuss his presidency in any way that wasn't that wouldn't betray my political slant. So I chose to focus on his Alzheimer's, and I discuss that aspect of his life. So I turn him into a sort of a heartbreaking figure in view of. This idea that Alzheimer's is a really terrible, it's very terrible for the people who love somebody with Alzheimer's. But I've often wondered if the person with Alzheimer's is perfectly fine inside because they're living out some significant aspects of their life that they enjoyed enough theoretically to revisit. And I know that's a conceit on my part and probably a fiction, but in terms of the song, it seemed a very, very good way to deal with this figure who's one of the most mythologized presidents in American popular thought.
And the song is called Such a Marvelous Dream.
Ronald awoke and washed his face in the sink. He had a marvelous dream. See, I'll be
Such a Marvelous Dream, song about Ronald Reagan from the album Of Great and Mortal Men, 43 songs for 43 U.S. presidencies. And Christian, Jeff, once again, there is this kind of wistful tone to this song, as there is on a lot of these, and a sense that, you know, whatever your political leanings, that at the end of the day, you guys kind of like these people that you're writing about. Would that be fair to say?
Well, we're wistful guys, yes, Jeff?
Yeah. I think the longer answer is just that we really wanted to look at the humanity of these people. I mean, it's much easier as a songwriter, I think, to really annihilate someone whose you know, their range of policies politically you disagree with. But instead, it was great to challenge, at least on my part, to challenge myself to look at them in a more holistic way, rather than just analyze their politics.
Between shells and hands awake, shaking this failed grenade. Between heart and harmony, paying dues for the king. Into France and on the sea, thinking man over knee. And gone to see if this territory comes back to me. An agrarian dispute would surely report that beats their response to the industry that grew there. On war to be better than on a lead. Between shelves and hands awake, shaking this failed good night.
That's another song from the 3-CD set of Great and Mortal Men about the American presidents. That one's about John Adams, and it's called Armed with Only Wit and the Vigor of the U.S. Navy, and featured the band These United States. As I mentioned at the start of the segment, this conversation was recorded back in 2008, just before Barack Obama was elected. Thus, the subtitle of the CD, 43 Songs for 43 U.S. Presidencies. But the songwriting team did end up recording a song about Barack Obama in time for his first inauguration in 2009. It's called Someone to Wake, and it features Will Johnson of the band Centromatic on vocals.
Wake me up. When it's over, oh please just let me sleep. I was in a dream where everything was beautiful, and we were secure in the same little houses with all our big box stores. We can buy some more to prove we've made it big right here.
Well, that brings us up to date, courtesy of songwriters Christian Kiefer and Jefferson Pitcher. Their project called Of Great and Mortal Men was a 3-CD release, 43 songs for 43 presidents, and there's the 44th, written for our 44th president, Barack Obama. Still to come, Michael Chabon talks about the music that inspired his latest novel, Telegraph Avenue, and later, a tiny desk concert with the band Passion Pit. This is Soundcheck. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Chabon has a knack for telling big, sometimes heartbreaking, often impactful stories through pop culture. The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay used the history and tropes of comics. The Final Solution wrapped a tale around the mysteries of Sherlock Holmes. Now he goes inside the world of the record store with his latest called Telegraph Avenue. The book is full of music, so much music that the ebook even comes with a playlist that includes this track. Michael Chabon, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
So what are we listening? Who is Deodato?
Deodato is a Brazilian composer, keyboard player, arranger. He had his heyday in the early to mid-1970s. He's probably best known. That track is called Superstrut.
Right.
It's a great track, and the amazing guitar work by John Tropea on that track on lead guitar. But Deodato was probably best remembered for his very jazzy, funky cover of the theme from 2001 that also sprach Zarathustra.
The 2001 Space Odyssey.
Right, and
theme.
If you've seen the movie Being There, it's used to incredibly great effect in that film when Chauncey Gardner first walks out into the world. That's what's playing. And
can I tell you, as a little kid, I accidentally discovered David Bowie because I bought Space Oddity thinking I was buying Deodato's.
That's hilarious.
2001 Space
I wonder
Odyssey.
How many sales that accounted for of Major Tom.
One.
It's an easily made mistake.
So, but this is, I mean, this is part of the kind of soundtrack of this epic story that is a very intimate epic. I mean, it's centered around Brokeland Records on Telegraph Avenue in the East Bay,
right,
in Northern California. How much of a real place is this based on?
In a way, it's a very idealized sort of amalgam of a number of different establishments that have come and gone over the years since I first moved to Berkeley in 1997. The direct initial inspiration came one day about 1999 or so when I walked into a record store I hadn't been in before called Berrigan's that was on Claremont Avenue. It was a small store, not as spacious and as quite a great of a hangout as the record store in my book. It was smaller, but the day that I walked in there, there were two guys working there, and one was white and one was black, and there were a bunch of guys hanging out, talking, or came in and went, and they had little conversations, and there was a vibe of conversation going in that store, and the people were themselves, the customers were black and white, and nobody was really buying too many records. They seemed to be mostly hanging out and talking and just shooting the breeze and gossiping. And, you know, I was just really struck by the way in this very tiny little microcosm, some black people and some white people seem to have figured out a way to just hang out together and talk about the things that they care about. And that triggered a powerful response in me, I think, principally because I grew up in a town called Columbia, Maryland. That was a planned community that was built between Baltimore and Washington in the 1960s. And it was planned, it was designed and constructed around very, you know, 1960s enlightened great society kind of principles. It was intended to be racially integrated. I grew up thinking the world was like that. You know, when I left Columbia, I rapidly, very rapidly discovered the world is not like that.
Yeah.
And it never was like that again until the day I walked into that record store. And even though that was just a store and not a city, it still chimed for me. It made me remember Columbia, and it made me see how far I had gone afield from the kid I was at age 8. I had lost, black people had once been very visible in my life. And they had become invisible, and I was looking for a way to try to make them visible again.
Now, you remember back in the 70s, that was sort of the end of when radio would play black and white artists.
Yes.
You would hear Stevie Wonder followed by the Rolling Stones, followed by whatever.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that's part of why the 70s are very much the touchstone decade for this book, for the people in this book.
I just want to say it's not set in the
70s. No, it's set in 2004. Mm-hmm. But the guys who work in this record store specialize in this, the music like we were just listening to, the Deodato, the stuff that was on CTI Records and Blue Note in the 70s, and which in itself was a very much the product of the interaction between black artists and white artists, white composers and black composers and arrangers and engineers. And part of what still continues to appeal to me about the music of that period is the way in which it seemed to not just cross over boundaries, but to completely ignore them.
Well, it's not just that the music in the novel, and again, the book is called Telegraph Avenue by my guest Michael Chabon. It's not just that the music is the pop figures that you're referencing. I mean, yes, Stevie Wonder and some of the prog rock of the 70s right. get shout-outs. Mm-hmm. But the heart and soul of the lives of these people is this kind of soul jazz right. of the early 70s. Now, did you grow up with that, or did you have to research
No,
this?
I mean, well, it turned out I did grow up with it, but I just didn't know it. It was almost like that character in Molière who has been speaking prose his whole life and didn't know it. You know, I didn't know there was a name for this music like that Diodato. You know, it formed part of a continuum of music that started out being called hard bop in the 50s, came to be known as soul jazz. The music transformed over those years and then ultimately kind of ended its greatest incarnation as jazz funk. And what it all really means is music played by jazz musicians, but with the backbeat pushed really centrally into a position of prominence in the music. There was this movement that arose in the 50s initially among black musicians to restore the gospel roots, the blues roots to the music and hard bop. The first hard bop album is usually viewed as having been Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers' mm-hmm. first album. From that period, what you can see that I think makes the music really fun, especially the music from the late 60s and early 70s, is that this was music performed by musicians aware of what was going on in popular music around right. them, and especially black popular music.
And sometimes, as with Mongo Santa Maria or Herbie Hancock, they would actually cross over and become popular.
Right.
But more often, they sort of fell into this deep well of obscurity from which occasionally they're rescued by crate divers and people like you, Michael.
Right.
So
hip-hop has been very instrumental in
exactly,
doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these completely obscure records, we hear their breaks, those
exactly.
drum breaks.
And that was the other thing, the reason I discovered I did know it. I had grown up with it. And, you know, especially the big period for hip-hop for me was like from the late 80s through the mid-90s, just before the Wu-Tang Clan era, the Biggie and Tupac era. I sort of lost touch with hip-hop around then. But that intermediate era is when people like, you know, Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest and the guys in De La Soul, and they were really digging deep into a lot of this material. But I just didn't know that. When I heard these things, I thought, oh, I recognize that. That was in a Tribe Called Quest song, or that was in a Organized Confusion song. It turned out I knew more about it than I thought I did.
So one of the pieces on the playlist that comes with the ebook version of Telegraph Avenue is Manziel and the Midnight Theme.
Yeah.
I have never heard of Manziel, but
do you recognize it?
I sure
right?
do.
I mean, especially that initial break, right? That's like
from 3 Feet High and Rising,
right.
that classic record from De La Soul. You might recognize it as well, but this is the original from the band Manziel. Midnight Theme by Manziel, a tune that was later sampled by De La Soul on their 1989 album 3 Feet High and Rising, but this original appears on the playlist that accompanies the ebook version of Michael Chabon's new novel Telegraph Avenue. The book is centered around a used record store that specializes, Michael, not just in vinyl, but in this kind of vinyl.
Right.
It's a little, I mean, people will who haven't read the book will think, well, Nick Hornby, you know, High mm-hmm. Fidelity, mm-hmm. the 1995 book.
Great book.
And
great
effectively
movie too.
Turned into
yes.
a movie mm-hmm. as well. But was there any inspiration there or?
I read the book right when it came out and I really loved it. And same goes for the movie. And I still think that's one of Jack Black's best performances ever.
Mm-hmm.
But the situation of the guys who work in the store in my book is, and the reasons that they work in a record store they do overlap to a certain degree. I mean, they overlap to the degree that they are like the characters in Nick Hornby's book. They love the music.
Right.
And it's the thing they love most in the world. But other than that, I mean, they're older. In the case of Nat Jaffe, he's married. He has a kid. They're in a different position in life. They're actually in more of a position where maybe it's time for them to start making some more serious choices.
Yeah.
It's not just about which girl is the girl for me anymore, for these guys. It's more like, are you really going to keep doing this for the rest of your life, or is it time to get serious?
Especially with the encroachment of a huge record chain, which is moving in down the block and,
right. You
know, has a lot of money and a very famous ex-NFL player behind it.
So and a progressive social agenda, too.
Right.
They're trying to, like, improve this down-at-heel neighborhood and bring some needed community pride because it's a black-owned chain, mm-hmm. and they're going to be employing a lot of local people. It's this horrible thing that's happening to Nat and Archie in their store, but for everybody else, it looks like a great blessing. So it really puts them on the wrong foot.
We're speaking with the author Michael Chabon, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and novelist. His new book is called Telegraph Avenue. He's with us in the Soundcheck studio. When you're writing, generally, do you listen to music?
Always.
And what kind of, I mean, what we've been listening to so far has been instrumental.
Yeah, and pretty much has to be instrumental. I can listen to vocal music if the lyrics are in a foreign language that I don't know at all. Sometimes, but even that can get a little intrusive. It's much better if it's instrumental. And then weirdly, for some reason, I can listen to Tales from Topographic Oceans.
That is weird.
I know, or Relay, or maybe because the lyrics make no sense whatsoever. I know it so well, I don't really hear the lyrics anymore. Mm-hmm. And there's a few other bits like that where it's vocal, but it does. The ideal piece of music for writing for me is Steve Reich's Music for 18 Musicians, which has everything that music ideally would have to be good writing music for me. It's propulsive. It's instrumental. I mean, there are vocals, but they just are sounds. They sound like instruments. It is dynamically stable, and that's kind of the most important thing because I can't work when the music's constantly getting quieter and louder. That I find that very distracting, and Music for 18 Musicians is very steady in that way. It fades perfectly into the background, but not all the way into the background, and it stays at just enough level of consciousness that it helps me to sort of shut out my environment and focus on the work at hand without intruding. Over time, I've learned to work to all kinds of other music. Mm-hmm. When I was writing The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, I worked to Big Band Swing and Benny Goodman quartets and stuff like that. I do program the music to suit the project if I can. Sometimes it's weird things that work well, don't actually bear any obvious relation to the material that I'm working on, and yet somehow or other it's the right thing.
Well, I mean, you know, Juno Diaz was on the show not too long ago and basically saying the same thing. You know, he can work to instrumental music, but he can only work to vocal music if he's already got the idea and he's now just working the stuff out.
You're not listening anymore, yeah.
So, for example, Amanda Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't write listening
that would
to
just,
her.
I don't think that could work. No, that would be too, I would be too busy paying
attention.
Okay
for her to get married to Neil Gaiman in your house, but not okay to be on the stereo. That,
those
were
the
writing.
Terms of the agreement.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely.
The idea of vocal music, instrumental music, it sort of goes to a big difference between Nat and Archie, the two guys who run the record store, mm-hmm. and their sons. There's little spoiler happening there.
Teenage boys. Yeah. Yes, Titus and Julie.
Julie listens to not just vocal music, but the kind of vocal music that you have already referenced. Yes,
uh-huh.
Prog rock.
Right.
Kansas, much to his dad's chagrin.
Yeah, Jethro Tull, but like weird late Jethro Tull, like Bungle in the Jungle. you know, I mean, for Julie, he has inherited his father's, and Archie is a kind of uncle figure for Julie, someone he's known all his life. He has both inherited their tendency to valorize the art of the 1970s, like he's into blaxploitation movies and Kubrick films, and you know, he recognizes the value in the stuff that his father and his friend Archie love, but he still has to find a way to rebel and annoy and irritate his father. And so he very cleverly sort of seizes on this one sort of genre of music that drives his father insane and yet is somehow also impeccably credentialed from the point of view of being from the proper decade.
But Kansas, yes. Were these your bands as a kid?
Well, I still love prog to this day, and unapologetically so. I mean, Kansas... right. I mean, I got to admit, I have a little bit of a soft spot. And when Carry On My Wayward Son comes on the radio or Point of No Return, it does stir some deep memories of going around the roller rink, you know, when I was 15 years old, trying to follow some girl. But a lot of the great prog from that period, King Crimson, the early Yes stuff, the early Genesis, some of the little more out there bands like Gentle Giant or Stackridge or Hatfield in the North and Soft Machine. I mean, that stuff, I still listen to it all the time. I didn't, when I was a kid, I didn't like the more outre stuff that much. But, you know, it was much more about Yes and Genesis. And that stuff, I still like those early Yes albums, Fragile, Relayer, Close to the Edge. Close to the Edge, maybe above all, is just impeccably great music.
Now, Close to the Edge is referenced in passing,
yes,
in the book, but the song that you actually quote lyrics from is the song Portrait He Knew from the band Kansas. Portrait He Knew by the band Kansas from their 1977 album Point of No Return. That song is actually quoted, the lyrics, in Michael Chabon's new novel Telegraph Avenue, a book that is full of music, not necessarily this kind of music in terms of the two main protagonists,
right,
who like more of the soul jazz stuff, Michael, that we were talking about. I like that every time you mention a record, even when it is Point of No Return, in parentheses is the date and the record label.
Right.
Even if you don't tell us who the artist was.
Mm-hmm, that's
Point
true.
Of No Return appears, and it's like, I know that name. And like a few paragraphs later, it's like, this is Kansas he's talking about. It isn't until the next page that you actually identify the band.
When the father, in horror, says, you're not listening to Kansas, are you?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I have to say, first of all, that sounded pretty good to me.
Yep.
Those guys could play their instruments, and, you know, electric violin and tricky time signatures can warm the heart of an old prog head.
So, you know, this the story of Telegraph Avenue is taking place. It's 2004.
Correct.
There are still record stores, you
right.
know.
Well, that was the thing.
The internet is coming.
Right.
It's looming.
Right.
Is owning a record store now an act of nostalgia, of like almost willful nostalgia?
I don't think it's nostalgia. I don't think it's an act of nostalgia. I think nostalgia is one of the impetuses for doing it. It's about love. It's an act of love. You have to love what you do. And, you know, if you love records, and there's ample reason to love records because they're great and they sound fantastic and they look good and they provide a multi-sensory experience that digital music's just never going to give you, even if it sounds wonderful. And of course, the best digital music, highest resolution, sounds very good indeed. But the combination of the full package with the photography, the typography, the liner notes, you know, the smell coming off the old cardboard, and then, you know, the music itself that sounds so wonderful on vinyl if you have a, you know, an adequate system for playing it. It's you know, you are passionate about it and you want other people to help share that passion and maybe make a little money off it. You're never going to be looking to make a killing. You know, records aren't going, knock on wood, they're not going away. There's, you know, I think I read that more vinyl records were sold last year, new ones, than in any year since the CD first emerged or
something
like
that. It certainly has made a big comeback.
Yeah, so, and our new store is opening as we speak on Telegraph Avenue in Oakland. A record store called Stranded Records is opening up now. I just accidentally stumbled on it before they opened, and you know, is it a quixotic thing to be doing? Possibly, but they must think they're going to be able to make a go of it.
We've been speaking with Michael Chabon. Telegraph Avenue is the name of his new novel, which is a sort of multi-sensory experience with the book cover that looks like a record and, of course, the ebook with the accompanying playlist, which includes Johnny Hammond Smith and It's Too Late. This is another example of that kind of early 70s soul jazz that, Michael, you clearly feel passionate about, as you clearly do about lots of different forms of music. Thank you so much for sharing some of that with us on Soundcheck
today. Oh, it's been
really
fun for me, too. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. We talked with Michael Chabon last September. Passion Pit is coming up next. It's another Tiny Desk concert from our friends at NPR. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. Before we go, a Tiny Desk concert from NPR Music. You might have seen these videos. This one was recorded last year, and it comes from Michael Angelakos, the singer-songwriter who records under the name Passion Pit. Passion Pit's latest record, Gossamer, featured a song called Take a Walk. Here's how it sounds on the album.
All these kinds of places make it seem like it's been ages. Tomorrow's sun, new buildings, great sky. I love this country dearly, I can feel the ladder clearly, but I never thought I'd be alone to try. Once I was outside petrol stations, selling red and white carnations, we were still alone, my wife and I.
But at the NPR Music Studios in Washington, D.C., Michael Angelakos and guitarist Ian Holtquist stripped these songs down to just keyboard and guitar. Here is Passion Pit in a Tiny Desk concert playing the song Take a Walk.
Make it seem like it's been ages, and tomorrow some new building will scrape the sky. I love this country dearly, I can feel the ladder clearly, but I never thought I'd be alone to try. Once I was outside Penn Station selling red and white carnations, we were still alone, my wife and I. Before we married, saved my money, brought my dear wife over. Now I work to bring my family stateside. But off the boat they stayed a while, then scattered across the coast. Once a year I'll see them for a week or so at most. I took a walk.
I took a walk. The practice isn't perfect, but the market cuts a loss. I remind myself that times could be much worse. My wife won't ask me questions, there's not so much to ask, and she'll never flaunt around an empty purse. Once my mother-in-law came just to stay a couple nights and decided she would stay the rest of her life. I watch my little children play some board game in the kitchen, and I sit and pray they never feel my strife. But then my partner called, say the pension funds were gone. He made some bad investments, now the accounts are overdrawn. I took a walk. We had taxes, we had bills, we had a lifestyle to front. And tonight I swear I'll come home, we'll make love like we're young. And tomorrow you'll cook dinner for the neighbors and the kids. We can rip apart those socialists and all their damn taxes. But see, I am no criminal, I'm down on both my knees. I'm just too much a coward to admit when I'm in need. I took a walk. Still I hey. Why took a walk?
That's the members of the band Passion Pit in a sort of stripped down, bare bones performance in the offices of NPR Music in Washington, D.C. It's a tiny desk concert version of Take a Walk. From that same tiny desk concert, here's Passion Pit's Carried Away.
That get to my head. Wake up in the morning, wake up in the evening,
Wake up when you want to, cause no one's really watching. Well, she'll have something to say about it. We all have problems. We're all having problems, and we all got something to say. I get carried away, carried away from you, and I'm open and I'm praying.
Carried Away from the band Passion Pit, as played live in the offices of NPR Music, part of their Tiny Desk concert series, the original version from the 2012 release Gossamer by Passion Pit. That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, join us at 2 p.m. online at soundcheck.org for a special video cast live from the green space. We'll be taping a segment with producer Hal Wilner, who will be bringing in some of the musicians from his latest project called Son of Rogues Gallery, his second volume of pirate songs and sea shanties, all sung by different characters from various walks of musical life. It's going to be a lot of fun. 2 p.m. in the green space, live video cast at soundcheck.org. Then, tomorrow night at 9, Lady Lamb the Beekeeper. That's the stage name of Ali Spaltrow, a songwriter from Maine who now lives in Brooklyn. Her new album's called Ripley Pine. It's terrific, and you'll hear her perform in our studio tomorrow night. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.